Quick show of hands. How many people know who Savonarola is? Okay. How many of you can tell me more than he was a monk who was burned by the Pope for heresy? Okay, perfect. That's great. Sorry that this room is toasty. It is obvious, but it's very thematically appropriate, right? If Savonarola dies by being set on fire, he's, you know, famous for the bonfire of the vanities. So it's very thematic. The title of my talk is The Savonarola Option, Why We Should Elect Christ as King. Ooh la la. In the year 1494, the world was coming to an end. Now that might sound a little dramatic, but this is the Italian Renaissance we're talking about, and everything that they do is a little dramatic. But I think this drama, like all good drama, can disclose truth. And it's a very great honor to be able to examine what truth Italian history in the late 15th century reveals here at Virginia Tech with all of you. Thank you so much on this beautiful Shrove Tuesday. The first words of my namesake's pontificate, which you can find in Redemptor Hominis, paragraph 1, are as follows. My namesake, if it's not clear, is John Paul II. I'm not named for John Paul Jones or half of the Beatles. Redemptor Hominis, paragraph 1. The Redeemer of man, Jesus Christ, is the center of the universe and of history. This is an extraordinarily radical claim about how time works and how history unfolds. Time is not linear. Catholics could have told you that before any theoretical physicist. Time is centripetal. It moves towards a center. The end of time, in terms of both its conclusion and its telos, its end, is Christ, the Logos through whom all things were made. Christ draws us to himself through time and through the actions of his body, the church. Through the sacraments, especially the sacrament of the Eucharist, Christ transcends time and yet roots us in a particular historical moment of our union with him, namely his sacrifice on Calvary. The church loves Christ both temporally and eternally, both inside and outside time. By virtue of being both his bride and his body, the church displays across its lifetime the providential shape of God's plan for history, and how Christ relates to his beloved at different points in the history of their relationship in his various offices as priest, prophet, and king. One of the figures who is most attentive to the eschatological implications of history's movement towards Christ, and yet at the same time the presence of Christ in history as its king, was the controversial early modern Dominican Girolamo Savonarola. Over the course of a brief but extremely eventful tenure as the de facto leader of one of Italy's leading cities, Florence, Savonarola proposed a bold and Christocentric idea of politics, a republic which elected Christ as its king and held him up as its concrete political sovereign. His ideas about the kingship of Christ helped to provide an answer to a question which I know troubles the minds of young Christian men and women of goodwill. Troubles my mind as well. And I don't even think I'm generally of goodwill. How does one live in a world that is fallen and that displays its fallenness, especially within political community, without simply retreating from the fact that we are social animals and have a responsibility to our fellow human beings to guide them towards the truth? Though the church has developed its theology of the laity significantly since the 15th century, its central tenets were as true then as they are now. Lay people like you and me, I don't think there's any priests in the room. Are there any priests in the room? Okay. Lay people like you and me are called to serve as a leaven to the world, to evangelize the culture by going where clergy cannot, to prepare the way for the hearts and minds of those we encounter in the world, like gardeners preparing soil to receive a seed, nourish it, and eventually bear that seed's fruit. Savonarola's Florence provided the laity with extremely clear ways of participating in the life of the church, and through his vision of Christ-centered politics, integrated victims of abuse into the local church culture in a way that allowed them to heal without being ostracized or even kept on the fringes of the community. His critiques and attempted reforms of the church and the culture of his own day tried to integrate, I would argue, the primary Thomistic principle of good governance into the state in a way that no other government in history has. That principle is that the point of the state, its aim, should be to aim at the beatitude of its citizens. Savonarola saw the state as a means to an end of getting people to heaven. And that is the point not only of the state, but of everything. If something isn't leading you or leading a culture towards heaven, Savonarola would say, cut it out, remove it, excise whatever that is, no matter how entrenched or respected that practice is within society. Because the longer it remains, the more risk there is that it will prevent you from entering the kingdom of heaven. Savonarola sees the state as deriving its legitimate power exclusively from Christ's kingship. The state serves as a kind of knight of Christ, whose task is to go out into the world and win souls for God. If that knight begins to follow the whims of other rulers and to win souls for their standards rather than for Christ, the knight loses all his authority, as his office in the first place only exists in reference and relation to the king whose standard he should be following. The idea of a state that enshrines Christ as its monarch gives us, I would argue, a reason to understand why the cultural institutions of our own day, including ones like education, which are deeply entrenched in our notional ideas of what counts as success as a member of the body politic, increasingly feel devoid of any meaning. Because these are the false banners of the enemy, which are not ends in themselves, but only possess authority insofar as they are standards for the true king, who is Christ. I want to examine Savonarola's notions of how Christ's kingship reshapes our ideas of what a state should look like by proceeding in three steps. Step number one, we will take a look at Savonarola's life, reign, and death by situating him within his historical context. I hope you like history. This is going to be a history talk, right? So strap in. It's a nice, toasty room. You're going to learn some history. Oh, boy. Second, we will aim to understand Savonarola's Christocentric statecraft better through a close reading of some of his sermons and his most important political works. Third, we will conclude by taking a look at how some of Savonarola's policies might point us to ways that we can have a fruitful Lent. For those of you who are listening in the future, Ash Wednesday is tomorrow. And perhaps we can learn from Savonarola how to build up our local communities to be more Christocentric. Does that sound good? Okay, let's go. People in 1494 actually had a fairly good reason for thinking that it might be the end of the world. Things at that point had been a little spicy. In 1492, as everyone knows, the most important event was the election of Rodrigo Borgia, the Cardinal of Aragon, as Pope Alexander VI, right? Of course. So Rodrigo Borgia finagles his way through back channel deals into becoming Pope Alexander VI, cementing an alliance between the Christian monarchs of Iberia, modern day Spain, for the most part, except for Portugal. Portugal's its own thing. The Catholic monarchs of Iberia allied with the papacy, which made Italians ever so slightly nervous. The Catholic monarchs of the Iberian Peninsula, on the other hand, were having a grand old time as they celebrated the union of King Ferdinand of Aragon and Servant of God Queen Isabella of Castile, uniting the two most powerful Christian kingdoms on the peninsula into a powerhouse that would capitalize on the momentum produced by this union to initiate a reconquest of Spain, taking back southern Spain from Muslim rule. Oh yeah, and some Genoese merchant went on a sailing trip and found some land to the west and while he was looking for the passage to the Indies. Whatever, right? Probably won't be important later at all. But you're not here to listen to me talk about Spain, right? No. Spain will come back later. Right now, we should turn our attention to Florence, center of Renaissance art and intellectual production, all patronized by the munificence of the Medici family. Whose lovely family tree you can see right here in my terrible handwriting. Big shout out to Virginia Tech for retaining chalkboards, not those technocratic whiteboards with the markers, right? Hate those markers. Okay, Florence is proudly a republic. Its freedom, something which it held as a gift from their most virtuous classical forebears and their founders, the Romans. But it was the worst kept secret in Florence, the Italian peninsula, and the Mediterranean generally, that Florence wasn't really a republic. Rather, it was something like a monarchy with republic sprinkles. Something like a secret monarchy with like a Roman values chaser. Presiding over this ostensible government of liberty was the patriarch of the Medici family, initially Cosimo il Vecchio, the old de' Medici, succeeded by his son Piero the Gouty, gouty in terms of he has gout, not that he has like a lot of bling. And by the time of 1492, Piero's son, Cosimo's grandson, Lorenzo il Magnifico de Medici, this is the guy who they make all the like TV shows about the Medici about. Though originally a family of wool carters, the Medici had very prudently pivoted from the textile industry into the up-and-coming, newly invented business of banking, which the Medici adopted from the people of Siena and raised to an art form. The Medici had more money than Crassus, who had been held up by his ancient Roman contemporaries as the richest man in history. We are talking Scrooge McDuck levels of wealth that the Medici have, right? They have a basement. The basement is full of gold. The Medici, in a 1492 inventory of their properties, possessed several items that were simply listed as priceless, including the horn of a unicorn and a cup purporting to be the Holy Grail, to say nothing of their quote-unquote assorted paintings, which modern art historians now know included works by just about every great Renaissance artist you can imagine, including Botticelli, as well as Donatello and the rest of the Ninja Turtles. In addition to being insanely good art collectors, the Medici were patrons, some would say founders, of Renaissance humanism, whose thinkers recovered just about all of the classics we have in circulation today, including all of the works of Plato, first translated by Greek from Greek into Latin by the Medici's personal priest and physician, Marsilio Ficino. Without these Renaissance humanists, it is very likely that the modern university would not exist, at least not in the way that we think about it. Humanism and the Medici reached their zenith, the zenith of their flourishing, during Lorenzo the Magnificent's lifetime, a period which saw, among other things, the recovery at last of Homer, who had been lost for centuries. That's pretty impressive. But not as impressive as Lorenzo the Magnificent himself. Polymath, humanist, he's a diplomat. He writes some great poetry. He writes some of the finest love letters you'll ever read. And despite the fact that he's got that like Medici nose, which is like visible from space, he's actually fairly good looking. Lorenzo ruled generously as a master politician, solving tricky political disputes in the morning and participating in symposia about Plato's ideas of the harmonics of the soul and music by dinner time. Now, Lorenzo wasn't perfect. Recent scholarship suggests that his intellectual and romantic pursuits might have gotten in the way of his ability to rule well, while others have pointed to some moments in Lorenzo's diplomacy that suggested he had an ambitious and impressive streak to him. Nevertheless, most scholars contend that this was the golden age of the Renaissance, and for some it was, in the period we're talking about here, with the Magnifico, is basically like 1474 through 1492. Okay, this is like the golden age of the Renaissance, right? But we also need to keep in mind that by 1492, Florence was the capital of child prostitution in Europe. Pedophilia and pederasty, though ostensibly crimes, were permissible if one had sufficient wealth to convince the law enforcement of the city to look the other way. And Florence was so infamous for its sex traffic, especially old man on young boy, that Florence's name was infamously turned into a verb that still exists in several European languages. For example, in German, Florenzen, to sodomize, to do it in the style of the Florentines. And don't worry, that's just the particularly Florentine brand of sexual behavior. If you're interested in women prostitutes, Florence had you covered too. And just as with the boys, this industry had workers of all ages who lived in conditions so squalid that even by the standards of the Renaissance, during which time by 1492, life expectancy was 18, a drastic decline from the year 1300's expectancy of 70, accounting for infant mortality. Contemporary visitors to Florence noted that the city's red light district was especially foul. Even by the fairly lax and libertine moral standards of the time, public opinion was turning against the Florentine government as Italian culture at large began to recognize the inefficacy of Medici rule in terms of maintaining any sort of appropriate moral standards. Florence's moral decline paralleled Lorenzo's own health and ability to rule. As Italian historian Guido Ruggiero notes in his masterful survey on the Renaissance in Italy, quote, Lorenzo's later years, despite his careful corruption of Florentine republican institutions and diplomatic successes, were once again not quite as magnificent as once claimed. Troubles with his bank hampered both his role as a patron and his ability to support his more open princely glory. In fact, it seems he actually dipped into governmental funds to keep his bank and other investments afloat. He also inherited his family's arthritic disease and was forced to be much less visible in the city, a retreat that may have been related to the death of his brother and to his more suspicious rule thereafter. But the city and Italy were changing, for even as Florence gloried in its cultural leadership, lively social life, and rather wide-open illicit culture, it was being more aggressively criticized by those troubled by its distance from the still widely held ideals of Christian and civic morality. Still, many on the Italian peninsula relied on Lorenzo's diplomatic skills, easy political charisma, and overflowing generosity to keep the peace between the bickering city-states of northern and central Italy and the southern tensions between the papacy and the Aragonese kingdom of Naples. Then, in 1492, Italy's tenuous peace finally crumbled as Lorenzo de' Medici died. In his place, his young son Piero, who would later gain the moniker The Unfortunate, which is even worse than the gouty, right? Imagine being, like, you have the name as, I don't know, your grandfather. You're like, wow, what do they call granddad? The gouty? I sure hope I don't get a nickname, you know, that's that bad. And then you get the nickname The Unfortunate. And he earned it, too. He stinks. Piero ascends to become the unofficial ruler of Florence. At only 20 years old, Piero was extraordinarily unprepared to lead. He had received the finest education that all the money in the world could provide and was being taught and advised by some of the leading scholars of his day, including Angelo Poliziano, the translator of the Iliad, Pico della Mirandola, who writes the Oration on the Dignity of Man, and Marsilio Ficino, whose interest in Neoplatonic philosophy and astrology suggests for modern readers a level of religious syncretism and doctrinal edginess that Ficino's life and letters don't seem to bear out. In other words, Piero had all the rudiments necessary to be able to grow, or at least maintain, the health of the city that his family had cultivated for generations and diplomatic peace in Italy in a time of turbulent politics. But Piero, from the first, seemed doomed to be an ordinary man in a family full of geniuses. He likes to hunt. He likes to game. He likes to hang out with pretty women. He doesn't like to do diplomacy, right? He doesn't like Latin poetry. He doesn't, you know, if the Xbox had existed in 1492, right, Piero would be on there. Actually, probably he'd be playing, like, Fortnite just, like, constantly. In 1494, in an attempt to challenge the supremacy the newly united Spanish exerted over the Mediterranean, King Charles VIII of France took advantage of the death of the king of Naples in southern Italy. Oh, there's handouts in my talk for every. I just wanted, like, a paper for, like, me. That's great. Well, now you can have it that you can, like, take home, right? You can see all my mistakes. So you can proofread it and send me, like, an email saying, like, oh, this is awful. Charles VIII of France took advantage of the death of the king of Naples in southern Italy to reassert the Angevin claim to the Neapolitan throne. Charles marched an army. Thank you very much. Yes. I think so. I think we'll just charge right along. This is great. This is, like, fun. You can, like, skip ahead and see what happens. He dies, right? He burns. Big, big rip in the chat for Savonarola. Charles marched an army. This is Charles VIII of France, right? Charles VIII of France. He wants Naples, right? He has a claim to the Neapolitan throne. Charles marches an army over the Alps and begins to leave a trail of destruction in his way, crushing the city of Milan and working his way ever southward. The people of Florence begin to panic, as people might if they lived in a city whose walls contained more gold than existed in any other place in Europe during the time, and maybe more gold than has ever existed in one place in history. Trained by over a century of Medici diplomacy to expect that the family would have Florence's best interests in mind and could talk their way out of any situation, as the armies of the French king amassed outside of Florence, the people of the city turned to Piero, the unfortunate, to negotiate with Charles in order to save Florence from being sacked and burned. Their expectations were quickly disappointed, as during the brief meeting that Piero had privately with the French king, he seems to have agreed to all but hand over the keys to the city, completely capitulating to the French's demands to surrender the city's treasures in a move that was widely seen by the Florentines as a betrayal of their city. So immediate and brutal was the turn of the public opinion against the Medici that Piero, in a panic, fled the city with his family under cover of night, according to some sources, in the back of a hay cart, leaving the city completely defenseless. But despite his haste, he seems to have poisoned his advisors Poliziano and Pico on the way out, revenging himself on their critiques of his bad deal-making. So the moral of the story is, when you graduate, you know, if you find yourself in a situation where you have to leave campus early, poison your advisors on the way out. That way you're acting just like Piero. That is not an officially sanctioned Thomistic Institute opinion. Cut that. In the mornings, the Florentines awoke to find that in their moment of need, their leading family had left them in the lurch. A provisional Republican government was formed, though few had any expectations that Florence would survive the week. But then something spectacular happened. Lorenzo the Magnificent had accidentally left something of a gift to the city of Florence. In 1490, Lorenzo had invited a guest to the city, a Dominican, by the name of Girolamo Savonarola. Hey, that's the guy from the title of the talk. I wonder if he's important. He is. Born in Ferrara in 1452, he received a humanist education at the city's university, concluding with a master's degree. Though he came from a family of respected physicians, Savonarola chose to give up secular success to join the Dominicans in 1475 at the age of 22. At the conclusion of the letter he wrote to his family explaining his decision to enter the order against their wishes, Savonarola wrote, and I'm using Thomas Davison's translation here, quote, "If some temporal lord had girt me with a sword and welcomed me among his followers, ye would have regarded it as an honor to your house and rejoiced. Yet now that the Lord Jesus Christ has girt me with his sword and dubbed me his knight, ye shed tears of mourning." Though he entered the convent of San Domenico in Bologna, the same convent where St. Dominic is buried, and where you can go if you apply to study abroad with the Thomistic Institute, spring 2027, applications now open. The same convent where St. Dominic is buried, intending to become a lay brother, Savonarola quickly, as the awkwardly named but exceptional historian Donald Weinstein wrote in his survey of Savonarola's life, quote, allowed himself to be led into the priesthood so that he could minister to others. And thus, Savonarola writes of his early days, having entered into this happy port, I looked into the waters of the sea of this world and saw many fish swimming through its waters. So I conceived a desire to go fishing, and I began to catch some little fishes with love, that is, to draw some souls into port and into the way of salvation by preaching. Savonarola quickly distinguished himself as a gifted preacher and teacher. In 1482, the Dominican order selected him, now age 30, to serve the prestigious position of novice master at the convent of San Marco in Florence, where just a few decades earlier, Blessed John of Fiesole, otherwise known as Fra Angelico, painted his famous sequence of frescoes depicting the Passion, Annunciation, and Triumph of Dominican saints like Thomas Aquinas and Peter Martyr, which still adorn the church, refectory, and cells there. You will visit that too if you study abroad with the Thomistic Institute. Consider it. It's great. In Florence, Savonarola taught the novices Aristotelian logic and prepared several textbooks on the various branches of philosophy. Pace Weinstein, Savonarola's chief authority was, quote, an Aristotle filtered through Thomas commentary, though the young Dominican was a sharp critic of overusing any classical authority, noting that even as a novice, that the friars occupied themselves in all sorts of vain projects and acquisitions, and they devoted more effort to studying Aristotle than the books of Blessed Jesus Christ. While in Florence, Savonarola's writing and preaching took on a new apocalyptic tone. In a series of homilies on the Song of Songs, he railed against, and I'm quoting again from Weinstein, quote, this wicked century, its pursuit of riches, glory, and the pleasures of the flesh, its evil prelates and corrupt priests, thieves and knaves, the pomp of the church, false apostles, heretics, and worldly philosophers with their vain pretensions to wisdom. When will the day come when I enter your presence, Savonarola writes, out of that evil and most wicked world? It sickens me not only to live in it, but even to see it. My Lord, I would like to be with you always, to live with you, and sweetly to embrace you. Lord, these are the words of the bride inflamed with the love of Jesus. One of Savonarola's most common images was the church as the bride of Christ, despoiled by pride, vanity, worldliness, and lukewarmness. Savonarola's message to the church was simple: repent and sin no more. This message was not well received in Florence, especially when Savonarola's preaching took on a particularly eschatological flavor, as the Florentines were celebrating the death of the Medici's longtime enemy, Pope Sixtus IV. As Weinstein describes during this time, quote, Savonarola trembles at the prospect of a world become a battleground between God and the devil, with control of the church as a prize. The devil foments dissension over the choice of a papal successor. God graciously extends his hand over Rome and peace is restored with the election of a new pope, but that this is only a temporary reprieve. Without a great renewal, demonic forces will prevail and the church will suffer. Savonarola's sermons during this period were either so poorly received or so widely ignored that within a few years, by 1487, he had returned to Bologna to continue his studies, this time towards a master's in sacred theology, and during which time he served as the master's students at San Domenico. But Savonarola would not stay away from Florence for long. San Marco in Florence long had ties to the Medici family. It served as a meeting point for Cosimo de' Medici's confraternity and served as a home away from home for Il Vecchio to such a degree that Cosimo had a private chapel in the monastery, which you can still visit today. Perhaps inspired by Pico della Mirandola, whom had heard Savonarola undertake scholastic disputations against other Dominicans and who had been extremely impressed at Savonarola's wisdom, Lorenzo de' Medici invited Savonarola back to Florence in the year 1490. The reasons why Savonarola had been invited back, at the personal invitation of the head of the Medici family at that, are somewhat obscure. Some historians, like Weinstein, have speculated that Lorenzo wanted Savonarola to serve as a mentor to Pico della Mirandola, who, I'll skip over for the purposes of time, he had done some spicy things. Other explanations include that Lorenzo wanted to use Savonarola, somebody he thought he could use as a pawn, against other members of the clergy who were trying to gain more power. Some claim that as he neared the end of his life, maybe Lorenzo had a crisis of conscience. No matter what the reason, as Savonarola returned to Florence in 1490, his preaching began to be very well received. Even before Lorenzo's death, public outcry was growing among Florence's citizens because of the moral degradation which the Medici had permitted to take root in the city. Savonarola's apocalyptic sermons promised that this culture of vice would soon become subject to pruning from a sword which would cut through Italy. Between his stints in Florence, Savonarola had begun to experience visions, which inspired and further spurred his apocalyptic preaching. The image of a sword, wielded either by God or a wrathful angel as a way of punishing contemporary vices and a lukewarm church, was an image that Savonarola saw in these visions very often. In 1491, he was selected to give a series of weekly sermons during the Lenten season, during which time he preached not only about these visions he had received regarding the coming tribulations in the church, but also of the need for immediate repentance on the part of the common man, as well as the leaders of the city. His sermons were so moving that the brothers at San Marco elected Savonarola as prior of the monastery. The sermons also attracted a number of lay followers who quickly won the title of piagnoni, the Italian word for weepers, so-called because of their immediate and very public penitence for their sins and renunciation of their former ways of life, as well as their sorrow for the sins of the world. Savonarola's preaching continued to win him positions which he could use to preach and teach about scripture and the visions he had received. In 1492, he had received the commission to serve as a Lenten preacher for San Lorenzo, the Medici home parish. Though Savonarola had been careful to distance himself from the Medici family during his second stint of Florence, Savonarola visited Lorenzo on his deathbed in April 1492, where, as Poliziano tells us, quote, Fra Girolamo, a man eminent in both learning and sanctity and a superb preacher of heavenly doctrine, told Lorenzo, as Weinstein recounts, to keep the faith and to live blamelessly, but if death was inevitable, to endure it with equanimity. According to Poliziano, Lorenzo assured Savonarola that his faith... Sorry, Savonarola assured Lorenzo that his faith was unshaken and determination strong and asked for and received the frate's blessing. Sorry, I got it right on the first time. The night after his visit to Lorenzo, Savonarola had been struggling to find ideas for his next sermon. It would be Sunday, the Feast of Lazarus, and he wanted to retell the story of that miraculous triumph over death. Uncertain how to proceed and unable to rest, he found himself reciting those words, Lo, the sword of the Lord, soon and swiftly. The following morning, he repeated the warning to a rapt audience. That night, April 8th, Lorenzo died. This civic tragedy seems to be reflected in nature itself. A strange weather destroyed parts of Florence's cathedral, and crowds of citizens reported seeing portents in the sky, which suggested the coming downfall of the city. So if you ever think, like, elections today are dramatic, just think, when's the last time you and a bunch of your friends saw portents in the sky? I haven't. It's been a while. It's been a little while. Savonarola was clear that the sword his visions predicted did not refer to Lorenzo's death alone. For the next 2 years, he prophesied from the pulpit that the sword that was coming would cleave not only Florence, but Italy itself in twain. The sword that would come down from over the Alps, tearing Italy down the middle. prophecy which seemed to come to fruition in 1494 with the arrival of King Charles VIII and the Medici abandonment of the city. With the Medici gone, the provisional government in chaos, and the king poised outside waiting to strike and wondering where all Florence's diplomats had gone, the Florentines turned to the one man in the city who seemed to have known all along that this was coming, Savonarola, who reluctantly agreed to parley with the king and serve as Florence's representative. Our knowledge of what happened next is limited, right? Savonarola's would-be hagiographers in later years invent very fanciful dialogues as to what occurs. What we know for sure is that Savonarola had asked the Florentines to begin to pray and fast for the safety of their city and in repentance to God for their sins. Perhaps God would, as he had with the Ninevites, look upon their penitence with mercy. The French king appears to have taken a shine to Savonarola, who told the king about the visions he had seen, and that Charles, it was now clear, had been ordained by God to serve as a divine instrument. However, he told the king that the Florentines were repenting of their sins. To attack them now would risk losing God's favor bestowed on the French. Negotiations dragged. The Florentine government proposed terms in which they would pay a fairly minor ransom to the king in exchange for him leaving the city in peace, and they begged Savonarola to convince Charles to leave them and just continue on. After weeks of back and forth, Savonarola was finally able to convince the king to proceed on to Naples, accepting the Florentines' terms. As Weinstein describes, the chronicler Parenti said as the French departed that, quote, Fra Girolamo had worked effectively for our liberty, courageously telling the king that his dishonorable actions in Florence would now surely lose him the heavenly favor on which depended the success of his expedition if he persisted in attempting to occupy the city. Parenti, quote, concluded the city was delivered from a bad situation by a combination of Savonarola's persuasiveness and the bold spirit of the Florentine people who were ready to die to protect their liberty. Parenti was unable to decide which was the greater miracle, the recovery of Florence's liberty and the revolt against Piero with only one loss of life, or the death of only 10 French and Italians during the French occupation. Truly, he thought, the fasts and good works undertaken by the people at the behest of Fra Girolamo must have persuaded God not to punish them for their excessive faults, like Nineveh. As the city breathed a sigh of relief, its government began to turn towards its future. The provisional government had already formally banished Piero and the other Medici from the city, but in their absence, many were left unsure as to how to restructure their polis. Even if the Florentines recommitted themselves to their republican ideals, it was being a republic in the first place that had enabled the Medici to rise to power and slowly drain control away from the legitimate representative government. Furthermore, republicanism had also enabled the sins for which God had almost destroyed the city. It had enabled these sins to take root and flourish. Clearly, there was only one person who could guide the city well, just as he had in his darkest hour. Who is it? Guess. Savonarola, of course. Though the Dominican refused the Republic's offer to take an official position and the ruling party of the new state, he did begin to preach a series of sermons every day of Advent in Florence's cathedral on the subject of politics, in which he laid out a series of suggestions for the city's reform, which he would quickly be adopted by the city as its new unofficial constitution. Now, if you came to this talk because of the title, you already know who Savonarola thinks should rule Florence. Jesus, right? As he says in the homily, in his homily of December the 28th, 1494, less than a month after the French had retreated, Savonarola glosses Psalm 2. Ego autem constituus resum rex ab eo super sion montem sanctum eus. Christ speaks here in the psalm and says, I have been appointed king by my father on the holy mountain of Zion. Christ is Lord and King of all. Commend yourself to him, O Florence. I see that you would like someone to be your leader. What leader, what king can be given to you so that you remain at peace? I have told you before that one leader ruling alone is better for every place and every country. Now, Florence, God wants to make you happy and wants to give you a leader and a king to govern you, and this is Christ. See here, our psalm says so. Ego autem constituus sum rex. The Lord wants to rule over you if you would have it so. If you would have it so, Florence. But let yourself be ruled by him, and do not behave as did those Jews who demanded a king from Samuel. And God answered, give them a king, since they do not want me who ruled over and governed them in the past. They have not despised you, but have despised me. You, Florence, do not do as they did. Take Christ as your king and place yourself under his law by which he governs you. Act in such a way as to be this Zion of which the psalm speaks here, that you may stand up high in matters divine in order to descry them and contemplate them. Let Christ be your captain, the one who gives you a new reform of holy living. That reform which has been preached to you is nothing other than unity that is the love of God and neighbor. Now it's all well and good to declare Christ as the king of the city, but how does a government concretely restructure itself as to completely follow the will of Christ? Not easy. This was an especially tricky question for Savonarola as a follower of St. Thomas, who had said of Italy in De Regno that per Savonarola's description in his sermon from December the 12th, 1494, quote, this is Savonarola's gloss on St. Thomas, in the middle part of this hemisphere, such as Italy, where both the sanguine and the intellectual abound, men do not patiently remain under a single leader. Therefore, it is the counsel of the holy doctors that in these places where it seems the nature of man will not endure a superior, government by the majority is better than that of a single leader. And one could say that it is especially appropriate for the city of Florence, where the sanguine and intelligence aplenty abound in the nature of men. These men might believe, as Cosimo de' Medici often said, that states are governed neither with prayer nor with our fathers. But this, says Savonarola, does not align with history. Quote, the kingdom founded on the grace of God will be more spiritual than the one founded solely on and ruled by natural light. Consequently, it will be stronger and more stable. You have the example in our Savior, who has founded his kingdom on grace. See how powerful it was from the beginning, such that those poor, little, simple, and barefoot followers, with only the grace which Christ lent them, overcame the might of the world with weakness, wealth with poverty, the wisdom of the world with the folly of the cross. See also and read in all the ancient histories that men, the more they were in a state of grace, the more they achieved and won. Savonarola goes on to offer almost a dozen arguments about how a city founded on God's grace with Christ at its center succeeds even in worldly affairs more than ones founded on human strength. I'm only going to highlight a few, not all 12. Don't worry. Where there is greater unity, there is greater strength. But one who is in grace and charity has greater unity and consequently greater strength. Where there is more obedience, there is greater power and strength. But where there is grace, there is greater obedience. Hence, there is greater strength. When there are great riches, that place in its government are stronger, but greater riches are amassed where God's grace is stronger. So that kingdom is stronger because the common welfare and the public can be assisted in its needs. Eighth, where one lives virtuously, there are all the arts and business enterprises willingly convene, and so they always make that place nobler and more famous. So basically, in short, right, the more that you actually follow the kingship of Christ, the better your state is going to be at even stuff that secular states are trying to do, right? But even though that Savonarola agrees with St. Thomas on the fact that per Aristotle, the type of government most conducive to perfection and human flourishing is a monarchy, the nature of the Florentines makes it such that self-government is necessary. Savonarola therefore makes a unique proposal, a spiritual mixed regime. Though Christ will be the king, the supreme monarch of Florence, the longtime republican character of the Florentines means that the citizenry will need to enact Christ's wishes through the structure of a republic. Savonarola provides very clear guidelines as to how a republic can enact the wishes of Christ as king, taking as the unifying principle for these suggestions, servite domine in timore, serve God with a holy fear. First, Savonarola says, this is his first like big concrete suggestion, number one, if you want to have like a good state with Christ at its center, quote, confess with true contrition for the past, and with firm intention of never again turning to mortal sin, and that you attend to the common good of your city. I do not say that you should go to confession and communion once a year, but often. And accustom your children to these confessions, and so to simplicity rather than to pomp and vanity. So, in human words, go to Mass frequently, not just when you're required. Go to confession frequently, and bring your family so they can see you doing it. Second, Savonarola demands that the government remove, quote, all those things contrary to godly religion from the city and in the first place to act and ordain that the clergy must be good, because priests have to be a mirror to the people wherein everyone beholds and learns righteous living. But let the bad priests and religious be expelled. I do not say that you do it on your own, that you provide them, that you deprive them of their benefices, but with the authority of the Supreme Pontiff, see to it that the clergy and the religious of your city are good, right? So go, if there's a bad, if there's bad clergy, go speak up to the proper authorities and get them expelled. Third, eliminate with a vengeance the city's signature sin. Quote, pass laws against that accursed vice of sodomy, for which you know that Florence is infamous throughout the whole of Italy. On the other hand, it is necessary that you remove from yourselves, from among yourselves, poems and games and taverns and the evil fashion of women's clothes. And likewise, we must throw out everything that is noxious to the health of the soul. Let everyone live for God and not for the world, all in simplicity and charity. Now I should clarify, right, immediately, that Savonarola was certainly against public drunkenness and would doubtless be scandalized both by female and by male fashions if he were suddenly transported to today. But it's especially important to note that for the Florentines, taverns were essentially synonymous with brothels, right? Likewise, in certain respects, Florentine fashion is actually very, very revealing, right? If you're We don't have to go into the details, but the basic point I'm trying to make is, like, don't come away from this point that Savonarola is making thinking that, like, oh, we should burn women for wearing pants. That's not what he's saying, right? Fourth, Savonarola entreats the people to, if selected for public office, to do all, quote, first of all, for the honor of God, and second, so that you might not upset the universal order. Love God more than yourselves and the common good more than your own. If the city will, in this way, be good and full of charity, God will make her abound in riches, and the citizens will be able to share in them when they have been bestowed upon her. And what is more, the rich will be able to come to the assistance of the poor. This is a central tenet of Savonarola in politics, an almost Franciscan level of attention to the poor. Elsewhere, Savonarola recommends shifting public funds away from Florence's universities, which had only, in his estimation, served as sources of secularization and the propagation of paganism and an obsession with pre-Christian philosophy. And instead, we should put these funds towards public offices which focused on charity and care of the poor and marginalized, including the Florentine orphanage, hospitals, and the public debt, which governed, among other things, dowries for poor women. To care for the poor, physically or spiritually, was one of the signs of a city had at its center charity. Another of Savonarola's emphases was the need for all good private citizens to be willing to participate in politics. Though all Florentines must be, quote, above all on guard lest anyone make himself leader or master of others in the city, such people could only flourish when the otherwise virtuous were unwilling to get involved with local politics. Late 15th century Florence was a mix of landowners, optimates, sort of aristocrats, and tradesmen who had made sudden new wealth through trade or banking. Because the ins and outs of the Republic were such a headache, steeped in generations-long feuds that still confuse historians who devote, like, years and years of their life to trying to untangle them, many who were eligible simply decided to give up on participation in government altogether. A more balanced representative system, like the one practiced by the Republic of Venice, which Savonarola thought was the best Italian model one could seek, would require many more eligible citizens to take part in the inner day-to-day workings of the city. This would require an act of great bravery, but only by taking up these offices and enacting policies that displayed what some might later call a preferential treatment for the poor, such as the significant lowering of the city's famously high tax rates, as well as further state funding for widows, orphans, and dowries for the poor. Only through these methods could the virtuous hope to rededicate their polis to their true king. But Savonarola knew that enacting these plans would take more than just a monk, no matter how great of a homilist, preaching at the populace from the pulpit. Savonarola understood the power of what later thinkers like René Girard would call mimetic pressure, that virtuous action can be more easily take place in an environment in which there is some social pressure and social reward in taking part. To that end, Savonarola instituted one of his first educational policies, the reformation and education of former child prostitutes. For Savonarola, these victims, who had so long been discarded and ignored by the city, must not only be protected, but taken in by the church and nursed back to health. Far from squirreling them away to some orphanage, ignoring the shame the city had taken upon itself, and perpetuating structures of sin which preyed on these weakest and poorest of the poor, Savonarola saw these children as part of God's plan to re-evangelize the people. Savonarola dressed the children as angels and then sent them into the streets to shame publicly anyone they saw in a state of licentiousness, which ranged from public drunkenness to gambling to lascivious behavior. These angels also accompanied the processions which Savonarola frequently undertook throughout the city with statues and sacred images of Jesus and the Virgin Mary, whom he called the Queen of Florence. But most often, Savonarola's processions were with the Eucharist. These processions occurred most often on major feasts like Palm Sunday, or on days when the morals of the city would be most tempted to revert to their formal laxity, like Shrove Tuesday. Oh, hey, that's today! Shrove Tuesdays were also the day Savonarola had chosen to enact his most famous reform, the one that most people associate him with, the Bonfire of the Vanities. Vanities here meaning like a vanity mirror. The largest of which took place in February 1497. For context, Shrove Tuesday in Renaissance Florence makes Mardi Gras in New Orleans look like the parade at Disneyland. Imagine San Francisco in June, Paris's Moulin Rouge, and modern-day Carnival all wrapped up in one hedonistic package. I'll let one of Savonarola's contemporaries, Girolamo Benivieni, describe it. Quote, I say then that these youths, by the power of God and in the manner described, cleansed a goodly number of the houses of our citizens from the aforesaid lascivious, vain, and detestable things. Here he's talking about Savonarola's angels who would, in addition to public shaming, confiscate items that led people into sin, from dice to pornography. Quote, and when all these things had been gathered in a place deputed for this purpose in the licentious days of carnival approach, these servants of God decided to convert the usual licentiousness and ill-bred disillusion of them into purity and sanctification of spirit. And so, in place of the masks of indecent games and abominable speeches, they ordered that on the very day of carnival, the youths would have a procession. However, without changing their clothes, as in that one. Thus they wanted to make a sacrifice to God in an odor of sweetness instead of those other execrable festivals, fires, and caponucci of the devil, but with the same means, that is, with all those vain, lascivious, and indecent things which the youth had gathered. So basically, they want another carnival, but this time a good one for the sake of God. To this end, Savonarola ordered that an edifice of wood, capacious enough to contain the above-mentioned objects, this structure, decked out with a variety of panels and canvases of precious though lascivious pictures, part of the structure had castings and sculptures of no middling beauty, part has musical instruments, harps, lutes, citterns, and other such, part with a great many women's ornaments and vanities such as mirrors, veils, wigs, cosmetics, perfumes, and other such things, vanities without number, more than one would have believed could be in the city. Also hanging was no small quantity of chessboards, of printer's forms for making cards and gaming boards, and a numberless number of dice, tables, cards, and similar instruments of Satan. Above all, seated on a wide chair as if he were their prince or captain, was Carnival himself, in the form of a monster as filthy and abominable as anyone could imagine he would be in the eyes of God. After these objects were set ablaze, and this is a multi-tiered structure that's been built here with seven tiers to represent the seven deadly sins, so that way you could see the fire from just about anywhere in the city, Savonarola undertook a procession of the Eucharist throughout the city. The reason why Savonarola became so infamous for these bonfires is twofold. First, Sandro Botticelli, painter of the Birth of Venus and other classically inspired works of art, underwent a serious conversion as a result of Savonarola's influence. Inspired by the monk's call to holiness, Botticelli burned a significant number of his paintings during one of these fires, the content of which was probably sexual in nature. Second, as part of these bonfires, a number of books were burned, including works by Boccaccio, which in addition to evoking in the mind images of the Inquisition and the fascistic book burnings of the last century, caused significant scandal in a period in which a book cost about as much as a house. We're in the early days of printing here. However, what these accounts often fail to note is that these books were, at least for the most part, pornographic in nature. Boccaccio's Decameron, for instance, despite being, you know, one of the great classics of Italian literature according to us now, contains a significant number of very, very graphic sex scenes. The scholars have argued that none of these exist simply for the sake of titillation. In any case, the image of a monk burning books has, for most of the last several centuries, been what Savonarola has been most associated with, and is probably one of the central reasons why I think he'll you might never advance past servant of God. Another reason why it seems unlikely that Savonarola will ever be officially declared a saint is because he's spent his last few years excommunicated. A staunch critic of any form of clerical abuse, Savonarola eventually turned his attentions towards railing against the practices of the current pope, the Spaniard Pope Alexander VI, Rodrigo Borgia. I told you the Spanish would be important later. Now, some scholars have made convincing arguments in the last few years that the most sensationalist stories about the Borgias are probably exaggerated anti-Spanish propaganda. You may have heard, for instance, that Rodrigo's son, a cardinal, Cesare Borgia, competed over the affections, that Rodrigo and his son competed over the affections of the woman they loved most, Lucrezia Borgia, who was Rodrigo's daughter and Cesare's sister, that they were competing for her romantically. Whether or not this is the case is dubious. What is more certain, however, is that it seems like there's fairly solid evidence that Rodrigo had ambitions to turn the papacy into a hereditary monarchy, a plan he put into action by sending the brutal Cesare to lead the Vatican's armies in an ambitious and violent expansion of the borders of the papal states into northern Italy, including into Florence's territory. When Savonarola began to preach about the new visions he was experiencing, which framed the pope as a servant of the devil, proof positive of the corruption of the church, the pope commanded Savonarola to stop preaching on pain of excommunication. When Savonarola disobeyed the pope, Borgia excommunicated Savonarola and eventually placed Florence under interdict, a citywide excommunication which prevented anyone who died in its walls from receiving a Christian burial and or valid last rites, and basically kept them out of heaven. Soon, papal forces captured Savonarola, tortured him, and publicly executed him via burning in the same public square in Florence where the bonfire of the vanities had occurred. Never let it be said that the Borgias lacked dramatic flair. I don't intend this talk so far, right? I know that you're all, some of you are leaving. You need to. We're right at the end, right? We're okay. We're almost. I'm going to land the plane. I promise. I don't intend this talk to serve as a complete valorization of Savonarola. Certainly, his methods were extreme, and there's absolutely no doubt that he disobeyed direct orders from the Pope. Even though we might be justified in saying that Borgia was not the best Pope. But I do think that Savonarola's Christocentric ideas of politics provide us with some direction as to how Christians today might conceive of how we can participate in politics well. We are in a moment in which there is a growing moral skepticism about how much our state and educational institutions are actually doing what they set out to be doing. What should be ostensibly forming men and women to pursue human flourishing and live a life well lived. Savonarola gives us a very, very clear set of criteria for judging whether or not a public institution is doing what it should be doing. Is it leading people to heaven? Is it making people saints? If not, why do we care about it? Why do we keep it around? If we're keeping these institutions propped up with public funds, why aren't we giving those funds to the poor? At least that wouldn't be guiding people away from heaven. The only way to reconstitute a polis around an authentic vision of the human person, one that recognizes that we are made in the image and likeness of Christ who rules over us as our king, the only way we can make these social reforms possible is if we get involved with politics on the lowest level possible ourselves. Savonarola would have been unable to conceive of a republic as large as America's. And even if he could have, he would have said that there is no way that we could apply the model he recommended for Florence to America in the same way. However, as a good Thomist, Savonarola knew that the most fundamental building block of the state was the family. And the political structure that most immediately supported the flourishing of the family was the local community. To take Savonarola's advice and make Christ our king might not be a realistic goal for the American Republic, but it might be possible in our own local polis, like Blacksburg, or on an even smaller political level, on our neighborhoods. As Lent begins tomorrow and we consider how best to practice prayer, fasting, and almsgiving, let me make a pitch for a very Savonarolan form of sacrifice. Consider seriously how you can get involved in your local political community, not simply from outside of the system, but from within its offices and structures. What can you do in the spaces which most of us, myself included, often write off as the places where petty local disputes and feuds take place about whose water lines go where and where property lines begin and end, and everybody there is old and miserable, right? Rather than thinking about local politics like this, perhaps ask, what can you do to enter those spaces and transform them so they can become Christocentric? This is my Lenten challenge to you, a new form of almsgiving. Give yourself up to the poor by serving them, by reforming your local political communities. One final coda. After Savonarola died, Florence became a republic again, and then it fell back into Medici control, and then the Medici were kicked out again, and it became a republic again under the hands of Savonarola's supporters, but now a few decades older. During that time, in the absence of the friar, who was burned, but following in his footsteps, the people made a general election in which they voted for a new leader, a new king to replace the reinstated Medici. They voted unanimously for Christ. Though the Medici would take back Florence over one final time, Christ was never actually officially unseated as king of Florence. So if you're ever looking for a reason to travel to one of the greatest cities in the world, perhaps you should go and visit what is, technically speaking, the kingdom of God on earth. Thank you very much.